Hello? Oh, that time. That time I hear, you heard me. Okay. Okay, so Molly Perry. And she is examining the response of individuals and communities to imperial reforms and the participation of colonists in a transatlantic debate over the shape of the expanded British Empire on the eve of the American Revolution. And without further ado, the title of her paper is before you. And Molly, it's all yours. Actually, maybe what I should do is also introduce Richard at the same time, the way the previous moderator did. Okay, and the second speaker is Richard Hussey from the University of Liverpool. And he is a lecturer in history at the university there. And his first book, Freedom Burning, Anti-Slavery and Empire in Victorian Britain, was published last year by Cornell University Press. Okay. So, Molly.
Thank you, and I'd like to actually begin by thanking the organizers of the conference, my fellow panelists. I'm looking forward to the conversations and discussions over the next few days. So my presentation is entitled, There Can Be No Friendship, The Contentious Nature of Non-Importation, otherwise known as boycotts later on the American Road to Revolution. In port cities across British North America, the repeal of the Stamp Act in 1766 sparked celebrations. In Charleston, pictured here, white residents, quote, intoxicated with joy, and undoubtedly rum as well, rang the church bells at St. Michael's, hung banners in British colors from their windows. They watched the colonial militia parade through the streets, while out in the harbor, ships strung flags from mast to mast, and celebratory cannon rang from the fort. In recognition of, quote, our happy deliverance from that night, the town illuminated with bonfires and other demonstrations of joy, including a grand firework display. Yearly, the celebrations for the Stamp Act repeal possess this dual tone, on one hand expressing fidelity to the king and parliament, toasting his majesty, and erecting a statue for parliamentarian William Pitt, an undying commitment to the British Empire. On the other, emphasizing the importance of unified colonial action to protect English liberty, shouting liberty in the street and commissioning portraits of members of the Stamp Act Congress. Colonists treated the Stamp Act repeal as a day of thanksgiving for their delivery from that dread act, a day to honor, quote, the patriots in Britain and America, and a day to celebrate and reflect upon the preservation of British liberties. In March of 1769, colonial radicals gathered under the large live oak tree at the edge of Charleston that served as the local liberty tree to commemorate the third anniversary of the Stamp Act repeal. The day began with a customary procession with, quote, 26 torch lights, a reference to the parliamentarians who had helped defeat the Stamp Act, to Mr. Robert Dillon's tavern, where the crowd, quote, spent the evening drinking many truly loyal, patriotic, and constitutional toasts. On this occasion, however, it was observed, reported the South Carolina Gazette, that the joy seemed to be dampened by the late Townshend Revenue Act. Somber toasts were then drunk in honor of the Pennsylvania farmer, with mighty cheers for his, quote, novel and genius non-importation scheme. Despite meetings, pamphlets, speeches, and toasts praising boycotts, the participants in this Charleston gathering felt little optimism for the resumption of protest or an adoption of an intra-colonial boycott movement. In response to the Townshend Acts and imperial reforms, non-importation or boycott associations had formed in Boston, then spread to ports throughout the North, including New York City. For nearly two full years, since November of 1767, reports of Northern protests had circulated around the Lower South and West Indian colonies. Southern plantation ports, however, stayed aloof to calls for cooperation. Letters from Boston merchants to their Charleston peers urging cooperation and resistance were, quote, handed from man to man, Lieutenant Governor William Bull Jr. reported, with silent neglect. The booming port city appeared unwilling to take part in a regime of strict economy. The inaction and delay that we see here challenges the reigning narrative of the American Revolution, which is typically portrayed as an inexorable path towards continental independence. With the boycott movement presented, to quote another historian, as a frenzy of list signing and joining, a process that built the mutual trust and cooperation critical to declaring independence. However, When faced in 1767 with the choice to submit to the new duties or join in protest, Charleston, the fourth largest city in British North America, hesitated to join her fellow subjects in common cause, ignoring calls to boycott British manufacturers. At this juncture, colonial radicals faced a dilemma echoed in subsequent protest movements. After the spectacular, perhaps surprising success of the Stamp Act movement, what lay ahead? How to reignite passion and interest? How to, again, rally fellow subjects? And specifically, how to persuade others in the colonies, and more importantly in Britain, to take action? Throughout the imperial crisis from 1765 to 1769, debates raged in newspaper pages, in taverns, and on the streets over the purpose and contours of dissent. At the center of this debate lay a new tool of protest, a novel experiment in consumer power, the Non-Importation Association. From New York to Jamaica, British subjects engaged one another in an imperial discourse over the ability of what we now call boycotts to influence and persuade imperial power brokers. This paper examines how these intra-colonial debates shaped the emergence of the boycott strategy, highlighting the controversial rather than consensual emergence of non-importation. To highlight contests between the colonies, I begin with a fiery pamphlet exchange that was initiated when Philadelphian John Dickinson, a bit younger than he is in this picture, and the author, he's later referred to as the penman of the revolution, and he's the author who best articulated and outlined the colonial boycott strategy, wrote a diatribe about the willing, unmanly submission to imperial taxation of his fellow subjects in Barbados, who responded in turn with a series of pamphlets of their own, articulating their own theories of protest. Across trade networks connecting the mainland colonies to the West India Islands, these often overlooked intra-colonial debates, which were frequently republished in third-party colonies like South Carolina and Georgia, were critical to the emergence and shape of non-importation associations. Past historians, primarily interested in the 13 colonies that declared independence, have missed how these exchanges and experiments and embargoes and boycotts between the colonies informed the emerging boycott strategy. Celebratory narratives of the American Revolution tend to emphasize this frenzy of joining, the excitement of signing one's name to boycott schemes, without considering the controversial, divisive, and weighty choices faced by individuals and communities. I'm actually happy to talk about this process within South Carolina and in some other cities in the Q&A. South Carolina actually waits for 2 years and then over the course of 2 weeks has two mutually antagonistic boycott associations form. Kind of interesting. Capturing this moment of debate raises a new level of indecision, dissension, contest, and strategy discussion missing from current scholarship on the American Revolution and on protest generally. Studies of the American protest movements, generally, and particularly the American Revolution, tend to overlook the arguments central to the discursive process of dissent, thus leaving the impression that successful boycott movements, such as American non-importation, instantly united a fractious people in common cause. Progressive narratives of the American Revolution fail to consider alternative possibilities. They fit neatly within a political narrative emphasizing the protest tradition in America as restrained and consensual, leaving little place to understand include disturbances like Shays' Rebellion or 20th century labor unrest. Additionally, this neat narrative of American protest raises false expectations for present movements, such as Occupy Wall Street or even the Tea Party Patriots, that protest movements in America emerge fully formed and articulated without this period of creative, often contentious debate over lists of grievances, goals, and tactics. Analyzing these debates as at the origins of non-importation agreements, I argue, reveals a full spectrum of the choices British colonial subjects possessed in response to imperial reform, which helps answer why, in some port towns, non-importation or boycott schemes emerged as the preferred method to influence empire. By capturing this tumultuous path towards North American boycott movements and independence, we gain critical insights on the difficulties of building boycott movements across geographic space and between diverse peoples. Colonial planners hoped and promoters hoped that by boycotting British goods, colonists could demonstrate their economic power as consumers and members of the British Empire. As a strategy of dissent, the signers of associations believed that the boycott could gravely injure British commerce, effectively awakening British merchants. So, as a contemporary described it, quote, they would see, they would feel the oppressions we'd grown under and exert themselves to procure us redress. Some believe the American colonies practicing frugality and supporting local manufacturers would unleash, quote, such a disturbance among unemployed Englishmen at home as would endanger the heads and necks of the authors of the offending laws. The non-importation of British manufacturers, it was hoped, would demonstrate the population numbers of American Britons, develop local industry, and create unrest in England, all leading to the repeal of the offensive acts. Additionally, by creating subscription lists and limiting the number of participants, the boycott movement could exclude the unruly elements of society and relocate dissent from the uncontrollable street to the hearthside spinning wheel. To achieve the central goal of repeal, supporters of the boycott needed a clear message and a broad consensus throughout the British Empire, in the West, particularly the colonies in the Western Hemisphere, stretching here from Canada through Grenada. That cooperation and mutual trust, however, proved elusive. Even in these initial experiments, boycotts were controversial. There existed little agreement on any element of the American boycott. Absolutely no order whatsoever governed when cities abandoned or adopted and then abandoned again boycott schemes. And lists of excluded goods varied wildly from port to port, ranging from, among other things, hats in Boston, pickles are not supposed to be imported in Virginia, slaves in both Charleston and Virginia are part of the list of things not to import. Predictions for the effects of boycotts as well ranged from the optimistic that boycotts would successfully create an independent American manufacturing to the dark that non-importation would inaugurate new, more punitive responses from British administration, perhaps even military action. Upon learning of the Stamp Act repeal, Upon learning of the Stamp Act repeal, many mainland American colonists felt vindicated that as Lord Camden declared, quote, the Americans are the sons and not the bastards of England. As other historians have noted, colonists proudly embraced these mother-child analogies throughout their disagreements. Imperial reform challenged colonial assumptions of their power and position within the global British Empire, forcing colonists to reassess both their relationships with their, quote, dear mother country, as well as their, quote, sister colonies. The rhetorical use of family analogies proves rich, it proves rich in considering how colonists assessed one another's actions, and also jockeyed like jealous siblings for position within the empire. Universal dislike of the Stamp Act in British North America, and this is actually one of the scenes from the streets, as is this one, a little bit more riotous. There are actually two separate protests occurring here, Lady Liberty's in a coffin being carried on a parade, and they also have the effigy of the Stamp Man. Universal dislike of the Stamp Act in British North America did not translate into united action. Rather, a sense of both competition and betrayal emerged between the sister colonies. As stamp distributors in northern port towns watched their effigies burn and resign their commissions, in Barbados, Antigua, and Jamaica, colonists willingly paid the new duty. When stamped papers arrived from these sugar islands, colonists in Annapolis, Maryland, burnt them in the public square, calling for a shipping embargo to effectively starve these, quote, Creole slaves for their disloyalty. Mainland patriots lambasted the, quote, poor, mean-spirited, cowardly, dastardly Creoles, proposing for the first time that no son of liberty should sell those islands life-sustaining fresh or salt provisions until they joined in unified opposition. A boycott of West Indian ports would deny the islands the, quote, comfortable enjoyment of every delicious dainty from us till they are brought to such a state of despondency without anything but stinking fish and false doctrine. This first effective shipping embargo powerfully informed an emerging strategy of non-importation. For as colonial ships increasingly refused to visit, quote, any island where stamp papers were used, the colonies of Antigua and Barbados grudgingly began to, quote, curse the stamp law heartily, contacting their agents and lobby in London, demanding repeal. Through commerce, colonists learned that they could persuade others to act. The letter, this is actually the letter that they send to their agent to get their agent to start petitioning. The letter of the Committee of Correspondence in Barbados to their agent in London demanding repeal of the Stamp Act, however, did little to ease the tensions between the sibling colonies. Noting their absolute submission to, quote, with all obedience to the Act of Parliament, the Assembly of Barbados joined the anti-stamp campaign while re-emphasizing their, quote, loyalty to our king and obedience to the laws of our mother country, in contrast with the, quote, violent spirit raised in the North American colonies. While agitating for repeal, the representatives of the Assembly of Barbados delineated a clear role for themselves as practicing legitimate dissent through approved channels in contrast to their unruly neighbors. fuming North American colonists, even after the Stamp Act repeal, felt as though no punishment could be devised for Barbados and Jamaica for their base desertion to the cause of liberty, their tame surrender to the rights of Britain, and their timid resignation to slavery. Raising his pen, Pennsylvania lawyer John Dickinson, who was a graduate of Middle Temple and in fact met many of the plantation owners while he was here, wrote, quote, an address to the Committee of Correspondence in Barbados, a widely published pamphlet, to answer this their anti-stamp petition. After first questioning if the entire island had been, quote, drugged into a slumber, Dickinson articulated how and why protest emerged throughout the colonies, while suggesting for the first time this novel boycott scheme to defend English liberties. Urging unity, Dickinson criticized the, quote, needless stroke against your fellow subjects contained in the committee's address, for, quote, the cause of one is the cause of all. Most troubling for the British Union, according to Dickinson, was the Barbadian obsession that their, quote, submissive behavior would be well spoken of at St. James or St. Stephen's, at Guildhall, or the Royal Exchange. Choosing to purchase some sort of reputation from corrupt ministers, Barbadians abandoned liberty for slavery. Since there can be, quote, no free friendship between freemen and slaves, the Island Assembly of Barbados, he continued, must, quote, now immediately, vigorously, and unanimously exert themselves in the most firm but most peaceable manner for obtaining relief alongside her fellow colonies, or face ostracism from trade between the sister colonies. Incensed as, quote, gentlemen and the descendants of Britons to be painted as slaves prostrate in the dirt, three separate authors wrote pamphlets in response. A speaker of the Barbados Assembly, John Gay Alleny, the rector of St. James Parish, Kenneth Morrison, an anonymous author positioning himself as a mediator. Together, the authors insisted that the island remain loyal to her ancient settlers' rights of British liberty, but continued defending Barbados in action. Here's a map of Barbados. Barbados in action and submission as, quote, founded on the wisest policy without unmanly fear. Acting with, quote, some reserve and modesty, Alleny and Morrison both argued the white inhabitants of Barbados exercised, quote, common prudence, moderation, good sense, and just discernment, applying to their powerful metropolitan lobby and friends in trade to secure repeal. By taking to the streets, leveling houses, and attacking royal officials, North Americans, the Barbadian authors contended, permitted the Stamp Act to unleash a far scarier tyranny. As, quote, robbed of their senses, colonists had exposed themselves to be robbed of everything else. On the streets of port cities, these excesses of popular fury knew no bounds. Such out-of-doors protest, each argued, would incite slave riots in the colonies, while in Barbados, and whites in Barbados would not risk such an outcome in order to avoid paying a small tax. Accusations that protesting subjects advocated violence struck a chord with Pennsylvanian John Dickinson, who both dismissed the Barbadian emphasis on riots and tumults as involving, quote, only a few of the lower rank who disturbed us with two or three mobs, probably closer to 30 or 40, while also asking for more details of what the islanders knew. Concerned with imperial perceptions of, quote, widespread violence, Dickinson wrote how my soul sickens at the scenes that obtrude themselves on my imagination. I'm very sorry that many things have been done. The perception of anti-stamp protests leading to violence informed the emergence and evolution of new boycott strategy, which would resonate imperially while limiting unrest locally. Intra-colonial debates over violence reveal an important context for the development of the non-importation movement. Dickinson and his correspondents demonstrated a concern for how protest was perceived, developing boycotts in response as a strategy to limit potential violence in order to build a unified and larger colonial movement stretching from Nova Scotia to Grenada. Non-importation was carefully calculated to limit individual and community risk while gaining imperial rewards. From the very outset, the presence of slaves and sailors in plantation ports powerfully shaped these strategies of boycotts. With enemies both domestic and foreign, the Barbados Assembly acknowledged that they were, quote, forever to be dependent upon the constant protection and support of some superior state. Living in a small and helpless colony, Alleny painted a portrait of a slave society under constant threat. Whereas, quote, North America, boundless in its extent of territory, formidable in its numbers, possessed resources of an empire within itself. His small islands, as you see here, complete with a couple of camels in there, I don't know why. His smiles contained only a handful of free men who could only have suffered by revolt. This, quote, hazard from within affected every southern and West Indian plantation port, weighing the best course of action to influence imperial reform. To, quote, resist one evil with not only the hazard but the certainty of bringing down more and greater evils on our heads, Reverend Morrison darkly suggested, would be both absurd and frantic. Street protests in fellow plantation ports of Charleston, South Carolina, and Basseterre, St. Kitts, revealed that the slave majority would take decisive action, either in Charleston shouting liberty on the street and running away in record numbers, or physically intervening during riots as they did in St. Kitts. Following the passage of the Townshend Acts, plantation ports appeared unwilling to risk possible unrest and insurrection. As petitioning and lobbying campaigns lay disregarded by imperial administrators and politicians, American colonists, quote, wondered and wept, appealing to British goodness. It now proposed, as Dickinson wrote, to take another step by withholding from Great Britain all the advantage she had been used to receiving from us. Let us try if our ingenuity, industry, and frugality will not give weight to our petitions. Dickinson and others turned to British history and Whig political theory for the proper course of action, proposing a, quote, justifiable opposition, which can be made without breaking the laws or disturbing the public peace. Building upon the logic first expressed in the Barbadian Exchange, Dickinson further articulated this theory of boycott in his subsequent widely published Letters from a Farmer in Pennsylvania, calling, quote, let us be united with one spirit and one cause. Let us invent, let us work, let us save. Let us at the same time keep up our claim and incessantly repeat our complaints. This became the rallying cry of the boycott movement. There's been surprisingly little analysis of these strategy debates at the outset of the non-importation movement in British North America. The most serious treatment of boycott movements by Woody Holton, Paulina Mayer, and T.H. Breen apply a diverse set of methods, economic, political, and material culture, respectively, to explain why boycotts appealed to individual colonists in North America, relief from debt, political ideology, and a vibrant consumer narrative, emphasizing the local benefits of American non-importation. Not importation appears from these accounts homegrown, developed in response to, but wholly apart from empire, a continental phenomenon building common trust. Local focus has effectively silenced the existence of this trans-imperial cross-colonial debate, with Charleston and Boston residents also weighing the advice and actions of fellow colonists in St. Kitts, Barbados, Jamaica, as well as New York and Philadelphia. Focus on the 13 colonies erases this wider network of trade and cultural connections that informed colonial choices. I argue that boycotts emerged from a desire to influence empire, to persuade imperial power brokers, and in direct communication and debate with individuals throughout the empire. Colonial boycott schemes were Janus-faced. Outward-looking, they were designed primarily to influence the shape of a global empire by demonstrating colonial unity and consumer power. At the same time, local associations looked inward and contained a large degree of flexibility and variety, shaped by local trade economies and past experience with protest. Far from building common trust, far from building communal trust and common understanding, boycotts originated and thrived in a contentious, competitive environment. Colonists who signed their names to boycott associations risked economic loss, potential retribution from British authorities, and the constant possibility of disorder. The individuals who joined non-importation efforts genuinely believed in their abilities, in their community's ability to force Parliament to repeal the Townshend Revenue Acts through limited protest. So the central question became deciding the most effective, orderly form for that protest to take. This is very much about excluding people as well from these protests. In the months and years that they debated tactics of dissent, colonists reveal a far more fluid, contested narrative than historians have previously considered. No single trajectory defined allegiance in pre-revolutionary port towns. Understanding the dynamism of these communities and protest reveals more accurately the process of revolution. Thank you.